And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
The following is Chapter 6 from Financial Fitness Forever. How will you diversify your investment holdings? It starts with a quote from Yogi Berra. In theory, there is no difference between theory and practice. In practice, there is. Diversification isn't an inherently gripping story. I know that some people want to roll their eyes when they come to details that I find fascinating. In a nutshell, here's why I hope you'll read this chapter instead of skipping it. The academics on University Street have found time after time that the choice of asset classes in your portfolio makes much more difference to your long-term returns than anything else you do. This isn't really a strange idea, if you think about it. Imagine you are a cook making a stew. It's reasonable to believe your choice of ingredients for that stew and the quantities you use for each one will have a profound effect on the success of that stew. You can't put just any old things in a pot and expect a great stew. Likewise, you can't put just anything into a portfolio and expect to make a lot of money. Great chefs choose great ingredients and mix them carefully. In this chapter, I'll show you how to choose great assets and how to mix them in just the right way in your portfolio. As you'll see, there's a huge potential payoff for getting this right. Thick textbooks have been written on this topic, known as asset allocation, and I have good news for you. You don't have to read them. I'll give you the essentials and show you how to put them to work for you. In my previous book, Live It Up Without Outliving Your Money, this topic took 6 chapters. Here, it gets just 1 plus Appendix C, the ultimate buy and hold strategy. Despite my strong views, you don't have to do it my way. You have a choice. Many investors take the easy way out by refusing to dig into the details that we'll cover here and assuming that 1 or 2 mutual funds are all they need. When you're making a stew, you can grab whatever ingredients are handy and throw something together. Your family will be fed, and if the outcome is mediocre, tomorrow is always another day. Likewise, when you wash your car, being lazy is not likely to have life-altering consequences. But when you are managing your life savings, a mediocre outcome lasts a lot longer, possibly forever. The consequences can change your life. If you or your heirs will need your money someday in the future, you can't afford to be lazy about this. From Chapter 5, How Much Risk Will You Take? You should realize the importance of properly dividing your portfolio between stocks and bonds to control your risk and potential return. Now it's time to look at the details of the stocks you should have in your portfolio. Lazy investors can get by with a mix of only 3 well-chosen mutual funds, one that owns U.S. stocks, one that owns international stocks, and one that owns bonds. Some investors even leave out international equities, and I'll show you why that's a big mistake. However, for only a little extra time and effort, you can take advantage of the many decades of investment results that make it clear there is a huge advantage when you own small company stocks and value stocks in addition to the large company growth stocks that dominate so many people's investments. In addition, foreign stocks now make up more than half of the world's total market capitalization. I'll show you that investors can reduce their risk and often increase their returns by including companies based outside the United States. To follow this discussion, you should understand the phrase asset class. Think of this as a group of stocks that share common characteristics that can be identified and measured and that have some demonstrable effect on risks and returns. This last requirement means that stocks of companies headquartered in Minnesota is not an asset class. But stocks of companies headquartered in the United States with price-to-earnings ratios of 15 or more could be one. When small is beautiful. In the 1970s, Roger Ibbotson, professor of finance at Yale School of Management, and Rex Sinkfield, co-founder of Dimensional Fund Advisors and its co-chairman until he retired in 2005, published a book on historical stock market returns that identified a relationship between various asset classes along with their risks and returns going back to 1926. One thing they quickly discovered was a pronounced difference between the returns of stocks of small companies and those of large companies. Over many years and many periods, they found that small company stocks, for example, the Microsoft of 1986, outperformed large company stocks, for example, the Microsoft of 2011. The reason is not hard to find. And Microsoft gives us a familiar example. The Microsoft of 1986, the year when its stock was first available to the public, was much riskier than the huge, relatively mature Microsoft of today. Back then, computer software was an industry with great growth potential. But nobody knew which of the leading companies of the early 1980s would prevail. Now, except for Microsoft, those software companies are all but forgotten. Bill Gates, Microsoft co-founder and arguably one of the brightest people of his generation, understood the risks of his company. When Microsoft moved its operations to what was then a suburban forest next to Seattle, he insisted that the first buildings be designed so they could be useful to another business in case his whole venture failed. Why should you invest in small companies? That's a good question, and here's the simple answer. Taken one at a time, small young companies are extremely risky. But if you buy enough of them, you'll pick up those that grow to become the giants of tomorrow. As an asset class, these stocks often pay off handsomely for investors who can take the risks. Thanks to the work of University Street and to indexes that track thousands of stocks, we can see some impressive long-term effects. Over a 50-year period, an index of the smallest 20% of publicly traded U.S. stocks compounded at a rate of 12.4% annually, compared with 9.8% for the Standard & Poor's 500 index, which is made up of the largest stocks. If you invested $100,000 and earned 9.8% for 30 years, you'd have $1,652,228. If instead you earned 12.4%, you'd have $3,334,182. The companies were smaller, but your nest egg was a lot bigger. Let's make something clear right away. I'm not recommending you put all your money or even the majority of it into small company stocks. That would be too risky. But if you put some of your money into hundreds or even thousands of small company stocks, you'll most likely be glad you did. Using the return figures I just cited, if you split your money 50-50 between large company stocks and small company stocks, you would likely improve your return over the S&P 500 index. You would be benefiting from what University Street calls the size effect. When value is valuable. There's a second extremely important effect that University Street measured for many decades and then quantified and explained. It's the value effect. Its message is counterintuitive. Stocks that most investors don't want tend to be better performers than stocks that most investors do want. Value stocks, as they are called, are ones with low prices relative to their underlying sales, profits, and other accounting values. There's always a reason, maybe valid and maybe not, that these stocks are in the dumps. They are risky, and University Street has discovered that owning them by the thousands is a good way to make money. That's the short version of this discussion. This information may be hard to believe at first, so let's dig into it in a non-technical way to explain why it holds up. The companies behind some value stocks are in dying industries or unglamorous businesses such as railroads, electric utilities, or garbage disposal. Some have awful products or management. Some may have just gone through a string of losses. For whatever reason, their prospects don't look very bright, and investors don't want to pay high prices for them. For reasons you know from our discussion in Chapter 2, Are We Our Own Worst Enemies?, investors often overreact to bad news, selling out-of-favor companies in such volume that their prices can drop to levels that make them bargains. However, there's always this very interesting question. When is a cheap stock a bargain? And when is it just a dog? The Gannett Company. You may not be familiar with the name of the Gannett Company, but you have undoubtedly seen, if not purchased, its main product. Gannett is the largest publisher of newspapers in the United States, leading an industry that for much of the 20th century was extremely profitable. In the 1970s, Gannett was the darling of Wall Street. Essentially a chain of dozens of local monopoly newspapers that could set their advertising rates to whatever level was necessary to produce the profits the headquarters demanded. In the early 1980s, Gannett made a bold and expensive move by creating USA Today, the first truly national newspaper using satellite technology and the overnight capacity of its own and other printing plants across the country to facilitate early morning delivery. The company invested in distinctive newspaper boxes and made sure the new paper was available everywhere for travelers. USA Today proved to be a great success, but society was changing. Starting in the 1990s, the newspaper industry ran into problems it couldn't totally solve. Advertisers had new ways to reach consumers. Newspaper readers had hundreds of new ways to spend their time and get information and entertainment, including cable television, as well as VCRs, music videos, personal computers, video games, and of course, the internet. Today, the newspaper business is trying to figure out its future in a world where owning printing presses and fleets of delivery trucks is no longer a ticket to success. When I started thinking about Gannett for this discussion, I was pretty certain that it must be a value stock. Fortunately, I could easily go to Morningstar.com and confirm my suspicions by looking at just one number. the company's price-to-book ratio. For Gannett, that number is 1.8. That number means that investors are willing to pay only 1.8 times the money they could theoretically obtain if Gannett shut down its business and sold off all of its assets. By contrast, Microsoft's price-to-book ratio is 4.5. This means investors think Microsoft's business is worth a lot more than its physical assets. Apple's ratio is 5.8, indicating a very high level of confidence in that company's future. The price-to-book ratio for the stock market as a whole goes up and down over time, and a single number doesn't mean very much. But University Street has taught us that price-to-book is a reliable way to objectively determine what's a value stock at any given time and what isn't. You can find some details in Appendix C, The Ultimate Buy and Hold Strategy. For now, just keep in mind that there's a quantitative way to identify thousands of stocks as value stocks. And conveniently for individual investors, we can invest in mutual funds that track indexes of value stocks. I do that. You should too. You and most other investors would probably much rather fill your portfolios with stocks like Apple than stocks like Gannett. So why am I telling you to buy some of the market's dogs? The reason is easy to understand and for many people, maddeningly difficult to accept emotionally. Investors make money buying stocks that not everybody wants and selling stocks that are in high demand. Many decades of stock market experience and many academic studies have concluded that investors reap better long-term returns if they include such value stocks in their portfolios. And remember again from Chapter 2, Are We Our Own Worst Enemies? We don't always know as much as we think we do, especially about the future. Just as investors collectively might be underestimating the comeback power of Gannett, they might also be overestimating Apple's ability to keep churning out high-end, high-demand consumer products. In the 50 years from 1961 through 2010, an index of U.S. large company growth stocks like today's Apple and Microsoft grew at an annualized rate of 8.9%, while an index of U.S. large company value stocks like Gannett grew at 11.4%. In real life, that difference in return is enormous. If you are approaching retirement, it is not unreasonable to expect that you will have money invested for 30 years. Here's the math. At 8.9% per year, large company growth stocks, a $1,000 investment over a 30-year period would grow to $12,907. At 11.4%, large company value stocks, $1,000 would grow to $25,501. The value effect works with small company stocks too. In the 50 years from 1961 through 2010, a U.S. small company growth stock index grew at a rate of 8.2%, while an index of U.S. small company value stocks grew at 15.3%. For $1,000 invested over 30 years, that's the difference between $10,637 and $71,594. Now we've covered two main factors that drive long-term growth in the price of stocks: size and what could be described as valuation. And here's the bottom line. Your long-term stock returns are likely to be higher if you tilt your holdings a bit toward small companies and toward value companies. When choosing the types of stocks you hold in your portfolio, you have a choice. Will you take the lazy, comfortable approach by investing only in large company growth funds? Or will you ask your money to work harder for you and take the less comfortable route of including some index funds that specialize in small companies and value companies? I hope you'll take the latter route instead of the former. One way to do this, as you will see in the sample portfolios in Appendix E, Mutual Fund Model Portfolios, and Appendix F, Getting the Most from the 50 Largest Employer Retirement Plans, is to have half of your equity holdings in growth and half in value, half in large and half in small. How can you have four halves? This is a miracle of modern mathematics that's easy to understand if you think about a deck of playing cards. It's possible to hold a stack of cards in which half are red and half are black, half have values of more than 7 and half have values of less than 7. One stack of cards, four halves. Amazing but true. Going global with international stocks. Once you accept the fact that diversification is good and you make the choice to include value stocks and small company stocks, it takes almost no extra work to invest outside the United States as well. Think of this as putting the world to work for you. U.S.-based companies represent less than half the world's total stock market value. I recommend you have half your equity investments in companies headquartered outside of the United States. And while you're at it, make sure this international part of your portfolio includes small company stocks as well as large company stocks, value stocks as well as growth stocks. Investing internationally won't necessarily bring you higher returns, but it will reduce your risk by smoothing out the peaks and values of the market, as U.S. and international stocks don't always go up and down at the same times and the same speed. In addition to large, small, growth, and value, I recommend including a slice of emerging market stocks in your portfolio. Emerging markets represent one of the best ways I know to invest in assets that have demonstrated they can provide premium returns at reasonable levels of risk. Emerging markets represent the great growth potential of young economies like Brazil, Chile, Poland, Hungary, and Russia. Once this category included China, a country that is now truly emerging to become a great world economic power. The average age of the population in emerging market countries is lower than that of most developed countries. As these younger populations mature, millions of people will become new stock investors and begin thinking about retirement. This will raise the demand for stocks in their countries, and that will raise prices. Stock markets in these countries have the potential to experience the type of success we saw in the United States in the 1990s. You can participate in that quite easily by owning one or more mutual funds that invest in these economies. For various reasons that I consider legitimate, emerging market funds charge higher expenses than you'll have to pay elsewhere. But I believe the potential reward is worth the expense. As much as I believe in emerging markets, it's important to remember that while they may be the frosting, they are not the cake. Therefore, limit emerging markets to no more than 10% of the equity part of your portfolio. If this discussion seems to be entering uncomfortable territory, I'm not surprised. Investors around the world shy away from stocks and markets that are outside their comfort zones. In Canada, One prevalent concept of international diversification is to divide an equity portfolio in thirds: Canadian stocks, U.S. stocks, and stocks based in other countries. You can find similar patterns in many places, including Germany, Australia, Great Britain, and Japan. Yes, Japan. Remember our discussion of how humans tend to be overconfident and think we know more than we actually do? Well, that's not limited to North America. In the 1980s, it was obvious Japan's economy was taking over the world. The future looked extremely bright. Japanese investors can be forgiven for thinking all they really needed were stocks of Japanese companies. But the bottom fell out of the Japanese economy and the Japanese stock market, and that country has been struggling ever since to recover. The huge earthquake in March 2011 was a major setback to that recovery. Japanese investors who once staked everything in what to them were domestic companies lived to regret it. Those who diversified outside their country, even when they may have seemed stupid, eventually were glad that they did. Even if international stocks don't increase the long-term return of a portfolio, the additional stability they bring is especially valuable to retirees withdrawing money from their investments. In fact, as we will see, international stocks can make the difference between a retirement portfolio that lasts a lifetime and one that runs out of money prematurely. Let's take a look at some evidence based on stock market returns for the 41-year period from 1970 through 2010. Here are three variations of a properly diversified portfolio. The only difference among them is how much they held in international stocks. All equity, 0% international, annual return 11.2%. All equity, 25% international, annual return 11.9%. All equity, 50% international, annual return 12.6%. What these numbers don't show is risk. The all-equity portfolio with half its assets in international funds had a 26% higher return than the S&P 500 index and at less risk. That much difference in return is extremely significant to almost any investor. To obtain that much additional return with less risk is truly a game-changing combination. At the end of this chapter, I'll show you the real-world effect that this can have on you as an investor. But first, here's one additional asset class to add to my recommendations. Real estate is more than where you live. In any retirement portfolio that is sheltered from taxes, you should include real estate. I'm not talking about your home. I'm talking about commercial real estate, which includes office buildings, parking lots, shopping malls, theaters, apartment complexes, hospitals, and other real estate that makes money. It's easy to invest in commercial real estate through mutual funds that own real estate investment trusts, REITs. The main point of owning commercial real estate in your portfolio is not to increase your returns, although sometimes it will do that. The point is to improve your portfolio's diversification and decrease its overall volatility. If you pay any attention to business, you know that commercial real estate has its boom times, lots of construction cranes poking into the sky, and its bust times, for lease signs everywhere. As an investor, you can put these business cycles to work to your benefit because REITs and the broad U.S. stock market typically move up and down out of sync with each other. That combination reduces the volatility of a portfolio, which in turn makes it easier for investors to stay the course. The suggested portfolios in the appendixes include real estate funds, both in the United States and internationally. Real estate funds fit well inside tax-sheltered accounts such as individual retirement accounts, IRAs, and 401k plans. But for two major reasons, you may not want to own them in taxable accounts. First, REITs are required to pay out most of their profits to their shareholders in the form of dividends, instead of, for example, using profits to buy more real estate. These distributed profits are taxable in the year that investors get them. Second, REIT dividends don't get the favorable tax treatment that is given to corporate dividends, so they are taxable at your top rate. Is diversification worth it? I realize I've covered a lot of ground in these few pages. You could very easily put all your equity dollars in a U.S. large company mutual fund and be done with it. You'd have a decent long-term return without having to think about small, value, real estate, international, and emerging markets. There's no question that diversification takes a bit of extra work, but the payoff for this additional work is so significant that it can literally change your life. The best evidence I have consists of historical investment returns for the 41 years from 1970 through the end of 2010. This period included three major bear markets, three strong recoveries, and a bull market that lasted for much of the 1990s. It included a decade of very high interest rates, followed by a period when interest rates fell to nearly zero. I don't know whether or not the future will be anything like the past four decades, but those 41 years encompassed a very diverse market and economic period. Any investment mix that held up well during all that turmoil deserves consideration as a worthy long-term strategy. For those 41 years, the S&P 500 index compounded at a rate of 10% per year. That's a very respectable long-term return. But it was left in the dust by an all-equity portfolio that was diversified, as I recommended, with small company, value, real estate, and international stocks. That portfolio grew at an annual rate of 12.6%. You might think all that diversification added risk, but just the opposite was true. The standard deviation of the S&P 500 index was 15.7% versus 15.3% for the diversified portfolio. Annual percentage returns are just numbers, of course. But let me show you what a difference those 2.6 percentage points could make to a real-life investor. Many people retire with $1 million in investments and a life expectancy of 30 years. So let's apply these returns to that. Over 30 years at a rate of 10% annually, $1 million would grow to $17,449,402. That's mighty impressive, at least until you calculate the result for a growth rate of 12.6%, $35,168,327. Some people would say this is an example of the magic of compound interest. A 26% boost in annual return doubles the long-term return. That's true. But in my mind, the real magic in these numbers comes from diversification. Not only is the return doubled, the risk goes down. Of course, I know that very few retirees will actually have 100% of their portfolios in stocks. I have repeatedly held up the notion of a 60% equity portfolio as a reasonable option for many people. So let's look at the numbers from a 60-40 split with and without diversification. In the period 1970 through 2010, a portfolio made up 60% of the S&P 500 and 40% in U.S. five-year Treasury notes. In other words, a portfolio without the diversification I have described grew at a rate of 9.5% a year. When the equity side of that portfolio was diversified, as I recommend, that annual return was 11.7. Applied to a $1 million portfolio for 30 years, the portfolio with only the S&P 500 in equities would grow to $15,345,909. The one with diversified equities would grow to $27,942,162. Your results won't be the same as these. Naturally, I can't promise that full diversification will outperform the S&P 500 index in the future. But now you have a basic understanding of why you're likely to get better results by combining all these asset classes and putting them to work for you. For a more complete discussion of these diversification steps, read Appendix C, The Ultimate Buy and Hold Strategy. When all is said and done, the evidence for diversification is so compelling that this should be an easy choice. Depending on how much money and how much time you have, this choice could be worth $1 million to you, or even more.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.